Good morning. It's nice to see everybody this morning. As is the custom here at Stanton Mennonite, I'd like to start with a bad joke. As Anabaptists, we are not Calvinists, but Kevin has preached some, has mentioned Calvinism in some of his sermons and things, and I'm no expert, but my understanding is that one of the tenets of Calvinism is predestination. And I have some patients who are Calvinists, and most of you know I'm a pediatrician. I've noticed that Calvinist babies don't ever get diaper rashes. Does anyone know why Calvinist babies don't get diaper rashes? No? No? Because they are predestined. Yeah. For those of you who haven't had young children recently, Desidin is a brand of diaper rash cream there. But so I'm not a pastor. I'm not a theologian. I'm not a Bible scholar. There will be no redaction criticism this morning. I really enjoy Kevin's sermons when he teaches us about a Hebrew word in 3rd Isaiah and those sorts of things, but that's not me. I don't know those things. I don't know Hebrew. I don't know Greek. I don't know Latin, except for the names of muscles and tendons that are in Latin. I have preached once before in my life, not here, in a different building, and partway through, some smoke came out of one of the light fixtures. So just be on the lookout for those sort of things. I'm not sure what that means, but anyway. But what I am, I think, is a guy who's always been interested in knowing what is true and in trying to do what is right. When I was in my pediatric residency at UVA, one of the things that happened every day was if you were on the inpatient services, at the end of the day, we had checkout. And that meant that the folks who got to go home that night checked out to the on-call team. So we each had patients we were responsible for during the day. And then the people who were on call overnight had to be responsible for all the patients. So we had to tell the on-call team about our patients so they knew what was going on if anything happened during the night. So this was a happy time if you were one of the people that got to go home. If you were the person receiving checkout, it was kind of a drag because you had been there all day, you knew you were going to be there all night and the next day and not get much sleep, plus you just tripled the number of patients you were responsible for the night. One of the senior residents, when I was a first-year resident, I always would get frustrated with him during checkout because he'd tell us about his patients, and I'd say, so what if this happens during the night? And he'd say, do the right thing. Well, what if this happens? Oh, just do the right thing. And I'd be like, I wanted him to say, well, if that happens, you should get this set of labs, start this medication, think about doing this. But he would never do that. He would always just say, do the right thing. And I found that frustrating, but in retrospect, I've come to appreciate, I think what he was telling me was, Curtis, I can't tell you, I can't give you a recipe for every situation that might come up tonight. You need to evaluate the situation and make a decision and do the right thing. So looking back on that, I was like, oh, that makes sense now. It was frustrating at the time. So not only with medicine, but with life in general, I've often questioned what is the right thing to do and how do we know what that is. I think it's human nature to want certainty, to know exactly what we're supposed to do. I think, you know, we often feel like if somebody would just tell me what to do, I would do it. I think that in some ways is the appeal of fundamentalism, whether it's religious fundamentalism, Islamic, Christian, whether it's political fundamentalism or the right or the left, or even scientific fundamentalism, we just want to have our nice, tidy box. We want to know what to believe and what we're supposed to do. The problem is that life doesn't always fit into our tidy little boxes. I remember once when I was playing high school basketball, we were playing a team who had a really good scorer, and coach told me before the game, he said, "All right, Curtis, I don't want you to do anything tonight but keep that guy from scoring. I don't want you to think about offense. Don't worry about anything else. Just keep that guy from scoring." And I remember that being a really fun game because my objective was clear. There was no question. All I had to do was stick to that guy like glue and not let him score. And that was one of the more fun games I played. I probably didn't score the whole game myself, but because it was clear, the objective was clear from the start. I think when we read through the Gospels, we see, too, where the Pharisees often wanted things to be clear. They wanted set answers and rules to follow. And Jesus would often give them sort of a vague answer or a nuanced answer or ask a question back to them or tell them a story because it didn't seem like he was into easy answers. For almost 30 years now, which makes me sound old, but my main identity has been as a doctor. I've always enjoyed sort of being in the action, especially when I was younger. I enjoyed working in the ICUs when I was in residency. I enjoyed doing procedures, lumbar punctures, intubations, those sorts of things. Once I got into practice, the office staff would often shunt the lacerations to me because they knew I liked to sew people up. One of my favorite things to take care of in the hospital was always diabetic ketoacidosis. This was back in the days before insulin pumps and that sort of thing, where diabetics would get sick because they got sick with something else, and that would throw things out of kilter, so their diabetes would go out of whack, or adolescents would stop taking their insulin for a few days just because they're adolescents and they do that sort of stuff. But they would get really sick, and we'd have them in the hospital and on an insulin drip and things. But what I enjoyed about taking care of DKA was it was pretty formulaic. You know, when their blood sugars do this, you do this. When their potassium does this, you do this. And it was very satisfying to watch them over a couple days start to feel a lot better. Their numbers got better and everything. They could go home generally in a couple of days. And I just enjoyed that sort of being able to follow a pretty set up formula to make them better. I think there's also a confidence that comes in understanding what's going on, even if the thing that's going on isn't pleasant. A few years ago, I was in the hospital myself with a blood clot in my lung. It's a long story. I was only in the hospital overnight. But somebody had asked me later if I was scared, and I thought, no, actually, I don't think I was scared. And I think the reason I wasn't scared is because I understood what was going on. Even though I knew blood clots in your lungs can kill you, and even though I was having chest pain and coughing up blood, the fact that I understood what was happening somehow was reassuring to me. So even if something bad happened, I understood why it was happening. When I first heard about the novel coronavirus in China in late 2019, I really didn't think much about it because we've had novel coronaviruses before. You know, we've had SARS, we've had MERS, and none of them really had an impact here locally. And so I didn't think about it a whole lot that there was a novel coronavirus in China because of these things happen. I remember one Sunday morning even standing over here talking with Danny about how in China they were building these hospitals in days to take care of all the patients. They were putting up these new hospitals. And even then, it really seemed like something far away that we didn't have to think about too much here. But when it was apparent that it was going to be an issue here, it was really scary. I remember I was watching basketball that night in March where they were canceling games at halftime and stuff, and I was like, whoa, I guess this is real. And it was really scary because as a doctor, I'm supposed to know what to do with these things and stuff, and I didn't know what was going on. At the beginning, we had no way of testing for it. So we didn't know if we were actually seeing patients with COVID or not for a while because, we didn't know what COVID looked like in a patient. We hadn't seen it before. We didn't have a way to test for it. I think it was about a month, I actually lived in a separate room in our house. Because again, we didn't really understand what was going on. And I was afraid of bringing it home to family members because I didn't know if any of the patients I was seeing had COVID. So Rachel and Jacob were home from college, our two youngest, because the colleges had gone virtual at that point. And thinking back, the precautions we were taking at home in retrospect made no sense. Right? So we were worried about making sure we weren't touching the same surfaces. So I would use a different door in and out of the house, and I would stay in this part of the house, and nobody else would come in there. And they would bring me my food on a paper plate so I could throw it away. So those were the kind of precautions we were taking. But to keep me from getting too bored, Rachel and I would play Trivial Pursuit. And so she would sit on one side of the door, and I would sit on the other side. The door was open. And she would roll for me, and she would move my little guy around the board and stuff so that we weren't touching the same things. But we were sitting 4 or 5 feet apart without masks on because at that point we didn't really know about airborne spread and stuff. So it's kind of comical to look back and think, wow, we did that for a month, and it really didn't make any sense at all. I also felt like in the midst of the pandemic, I felt like, there were folks working in ERs and ICUs and stuff who were just getting pummeled. And I thought, I don't really feel like I'm helping much here. I'm a doctor. I'm supposed to, if there's a pandemic, I should be doing something, right? But I wasn't really sure what that thing was. Because if there is such a thing as a good thing about COVID, it's that most of the time kids don't get too badly affected from it, although there are clearly exceptions to that. So I learned from one of my colleagues about the opportunity to volunteer giving COVID vaccines, and though doctors don't usually give shots, we usually make other people do them. I thought, well, that's something I could do. So I kind of latched onto that and began volunteering giving shots and found that to be a useful way to feel useful. One day after I had given a shot, the woman I gave it to looked at me and said, that was pretty good for a doctor. And then she just chuckled and said, I'm a retired nurse. I couldn't help myself. But what COVID really taught me was, for one thing, was just kind of how much I didn't know and how fragile it was to have my whole identity based on being a doctor. Because if you're a doctor in the middle of a pandemic and you don't really know what to do, what use are you? Some of you know I'm a big UVA sports fan. And I think by now everybody, even if you're not a sports fan, knows about the UVA men's basketball team, how in 2018 they had the historic loss, and then they came back the next year and won the national championship, this great redemption story. But in 2018, I had actually gotten to be present in Brooklyn when UVA won the ACC championship. I was there with our youngest son, Jacob. And that was a great time. And that was 6 days later where they had that historic loss. First number one seed to ever lose in the first round of the NCAA tournament. And that was a pretty dark day in our family. But I remember the morning after that loss, seeing Tony Bennett's press conference online, their coach, and just being so impressed by what he had to say and how he handled it. And thinking, wow, that's a guy you can cheer for, win or lose. That's a team to be proud of. So I remember that morning I had to go to the hardware store. So I put on one of my UVA hoodies and headed down to the hardware store. And some guy in the store was looking at me and said, "You knew what happened last night, right?" I was like, yeah, I saw it. But one of the things, I don't know Tony. I talk about him like I know him. But he's very open about his faith. And one of the things he teaches his players is that you have to base your life on something that's permanent. Something that can't be taken away from you, which makes a lot of sense to me. I guess the question then is, what is that permanent thing? I think for some people, it's easy to believe things and accept things and base their life on knowing without a doubt that they are, a child of God or whatever, how they would phrase it. For me, it's always been hard to just believe things. I like things to be logical and objective. When Cindy talks about teaching slope to her students, I get little warm fuzzies inside because math is so logical and objective and there's a right answer. Y equals mx plus b. It's beautiful. Are you guys aware of or familiar with the TV show The Big Bang Theory? Yeah. So for those of you who aren't, there's a character in The Big Bang Theory, Sheldon Cooper, who's a physicist, who's just like brilliant. He knows all the facts about everything. He's very logical, but he's also very bad at some other things. He's very bad at interpersonal relationships. He doesn't understand people at all. And sometimes I feel like I have a little inner Sheldon that I have to control, because sometimes I have to remind myself there are other things that are more important sometimes than facts, or at least that have to be given consideration along with the facts. I was the guy who in Sunday school would be sitting there thinking, but yeah, if you get swallowed by a fish, in 3 days you'd be digested and pooped out. And even if you weren't, there wouldn't be a big enough air bubble in the stomach you'd run out of oxygen. Or I'd be thinking, even if all of the water vapor in the atmosphere was condensed, there wouldn't be enough to cover the whole Earth. And even if you did condense all that water vapor, what are the other physical ramifications of that? So this is why it's hard for me to believe things. And I kind of assumed that other people would saw things that way too. And as I got older, I realized, not everybody sees things that way. So I think that's what one family member has referred to as my nerdish tendencies. I sometimes have difficulty with some orthodox beliefs. For example, atonement is a hard one for me. I can never quite make sense of the atonement. I've read different atonement theories and things, and I just can't quite, it just doesn't compute for me. It doesn't seem logical to me. Greg Boyd, some of you know, he's sort of Anabaptist adjacent. He is a pastor and an author. And I couldn't find it exactly, but I heard him say, or I read something he had written sometime, something to the effect that sometimes you have to commit 100% to something that you think has a 51% chance of being true. And he likens it to marriage. He likens your faith commitment to marriage. When you get married, you don't 100% know that you're going to have however many years of marital bliss, right? But what you do decide is that you have enough faith in that other person that you're going to commit to him or her. So that's how he says we should view our faith commitment. Soren Kierkegaard was a 19th century Danish theologian who talked about the fact that he thought a lived commitment was more important than right belief. So being committed to your faith, more important than believing the right things. And I hope he's true. I hope he's correct with that. I hope that's true. So my equation for faith, because I like equations, is based on the two scripture readings for this morning. Jesus said that the most important things are to love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and our neighbor as ourself. When he was asked who our neighbor is, right afterwards, he told the story of the Good Samaritan. I think we're all familiar with the story of the Good Samaritan. And the things that stand out to me in the story of the Good Samaritan are Jesus made the hero of the story a member of an out-group, a disrespected group. And also, the second point that sticks out to me is that it seems like he's telling us that everybody is our neighbor. So if one of the things we're to do is to love our neighbor as ourselves and everybody is our neighbor, then, okay, so I'm supposed to love everybody. Now, how do I do that? Which is the second scripture reading for this morning. Love is patient, love is kind, does not envy, does not boast, it is not proud, does not dishonor others, is not self-seeking, is not easily angered, keeps no record of wrongs, does not delight in evil, but rejoices in the truth. I think there are some people who are so mature that that's just kind of who they are. It just kind of exudes from them. I don't think I'm one of those people. I think I'm one of those people who has to every day commit to that because it doesn't come naturally. I can easily think of several times this week where I lost my patience. So if we take this approach to love as Paul described it in 1 Corinthians 13, and apply that to everyone, it doesn't always mean we have easy or obvious answers. Loving thing to do may be different in different situations when the details are different. And doing the loving thing isn't always the thing that makes you feel good. I recently read somewhere that as a society we're moving from a position of shared sacrifice to shifting the burden to individuals. They were talking about COVID specifically in this. And I thought, okay, that's fine. Every man for himself. I'll take care of myself. I'll take care of my family, whatever we need to do. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, I think the every man for himself approach is kind of the opposite of what Jesus was teaching us here. So it'd be easier just to look out for myself and my family, but I don't think that's what we're called to do. So who am I at this point? I'm just a guy who still wants to know what's true and do what's right. And the best way I know to do that is to try my best to love God and to love my neighbors.